Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is David Epstein, who's out with his new book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. This book, Range, comes on the heels, well, not maybe on the heels, more like the next train car down from his 2014 debut book, The Sports Gene, which was just a revolutionary book of its era, stomping a bunch of myths about sports, and especially about the 10,000 hour rule, that if you can be good at it, you can do anything for 10,000 hours, you can be good at it. It turns out that sports, there's a little bit of nature to it. But this book, David, you jump into a different paradigm in the world of sports and just in life in general. But can you kind of explain going in what a generalist is for your terms?
Yeah, I think a generalist is someone who has done typically done a fair bit of zigzagging before they find their what economists call their match quality, the degree of fit between, you know, their interests, their abilities, and what they do. And because they've done some zigzagging before they get there, when they arrive there, they have this breadth of experiences, often a breadth of skills, and sort of a wider view and ability to integrate domains and ideas that their peers who focused in more narrowly and more early often don't have.
We hear a lot about this in our area because we have a lot of small high schools around here that play sports, and the schools are small, and so a lot of kids have to play 3 and 4 sports just to keep the programs alive. And coaches for the other teams, even though they complain about practices overlapping, will still tell you, you know, it's great because the footwork you learn in basketball translates onto the football field, and then the agility in track translates into different sports. Is that kind of what you're getting at here?
One of the reasons I started the book in sports is because I was looking at all the research there and found that, kind of counter to what my intuition was at the time, athletes who go on to become elite have what scientists call a sampling period, where they play a whole variety of sports, they get broad general skills, they learn about their own interests, they learn about their own abilities, and they systematically delay specializing until later than their peers, but they have these sort of broader skills, and they then require many fewer hours to master new skills going forward. And so I started in sports sort of as the analogy or sort of symbolic jumping-off point, because that's kind of what got me interested in investigating this more broadly in the first place.
You cover pretty extensively in the book the careers of both Roger Federer and Tiger Woods. Can you kind of explain, they're both at the top of their game, or were at some point, can you kind of explain what their backgrounds were and how they got to the same point, and does that run counter to your idea for this book?
Yeah, so that's why the intro is called Roger versus Tiger, and so Tiger Woods' story, you probably know the gist already, but father gave him a putter when he was 7 months old, not to try to get him to golf, just sort of gave it to him as a toy, and he started carrying around in his little circular walker. You know, by 2 years old, he's on television showing off his skills in front of Bob Hope, and, you know, fast forward, by 21, he's the best golfer in the world. So really, really hyper-specialized very, very early, and that became probably the most famous development story ever. Roger Federer, meanwhile, we don't really talk much about his development story. He played about a dozen sports as a kid, you know, from skateboarding and badminton to swimming, skiing, soccer. And mother was a tennis coach, refused to coach him. When coaches wanted to move him up to a higher level, he declined because he liked talking about pro wrestling with his friends after practice. Continued playing badminton, basketball, soccer long after his peers were more specialized, and obviously went on to become the greatest tennis player in history. And so I sort of contrasted those two models because, one, we never hear the Federer model, right? Like, even the most famous athletes, like Roger Federer and Tom Brady, most people don't know he was drafted into baseball before football. So we never hear those stories. We only hear the Tiger Woods story. And my question was, if we look at the science, which one of these is the norm? And it turns out that it's the Roger story, and also that golf is sort of not a very good skill from which to extrapolate to all these other skills in the wider world, even though that's what a lot of the books I was sort of responding to have done.
Why isn't golf?
It's what psychologists call a kind learning environment. So a kind learning environment means it's a situation that is non-dynamic. People wait for each other to take turns. All of the information is available. Next steps are very clear. Typically, you're not time pressured. Every time you do something, there's feedback that is immediate and 100% accurate. And so in those cases, you know, they're almost like what skill acquisition scientists classify as an industrial task. You're basically trying to do the same thing over and over with as little deviation as possible, and it's exactly clear what you should do. And most things aren't like that. Even most other sports aren't as similar to that. So most other sports where you have to anticipate body movements or balls in real time, you have to use what's called anticipatory skills, where athletes learn to do things faster than really human reactions would allow because they're interpreting these dynamic situations, the positions of bodies and flight of balls and things like that, to start doing what they have to do before you could ever react if you were just waiting to see things unfold. And so that's a much more difficult situation. And that's sort of most of the world, not just of sports, but of certainly of the world of wider work. So people who study skill acquisition do not consider golf a good skill from which to extrapolate. It's a fine sport. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it as a sport. It's just that most of the books in this genre have used the Tiger story and said, this is the way to do anything you want to do. And it's actually a uniquely poor example.
You extrapolate this beyond sports for the purposes of this book, and what I found interesting was this whole idea of video games. And I've always had the notion in my mind that these video game companies print money. Atari, Nintendo back in the days when I was a kid, up to whatever the heck they have now. I'm not even PlayStation, I know, is one of them. But the story about the E.T. games in the landfill out west really hit me because it kind of ran against the grain of everything I was taught. What happened with these video games as they were developed? There's a lot of failure, right?
There was a ton of failure. In fact, the E.T. video game was designed by a guy named Howard Scott Warshaw, who before the E.T. video game, so he was a game designer at Atari when Atari was, in the early 80s, when it was the fastest growing company in the history of the United States. And he made a game, he made one sci-fi game called Yar's Revenge that became the best-selling title for the Atari. And so it's the best-selling original title for the fastest-growing company in the United States. And then in that same year, he was also assigned to make an adaptation of the film E.T., and that one became such a titanic flop that it was basically blamed for the overnight demise of all of Atari, and led to this sort of folklore that Atari sent like a million copies out to the desert and buried them, basically, in New Mexico. And in a documentary a couple years ago, someone went out there to dig it up, and it turns out there were some copies. Not a million copies, but there actually were copies buried out there. But the part of the book, the part of Range that I use that in, is to talk about the creative process and how, if you want creative breakthrough, you have to be really high variance, essentially. You basically have to build a system that tolerates these titanic failures and is sort of flexible and resilient to titanic failures, because it turns out that you do not get the blockbusters without allowing for them, basically. So you have to build systems that allow for both. If you want the big, you got to have a system that's resilient to those flops.
And that's not even something that's unique to our times. You use examples of even back as far as Shakespeare and beyond, and Thomas Edison. Edison had failed inventions and patents, and I didn't even realize Shakespeare wrote bad plays.
Yeah, I mean, the lesser-known works of Shakespeare are lesser-known for a reason, and he often wrote them between his best plays, right? Like between King Lear and Macbeth, he wrote one called Timon of Athens, which you probably haven't seen performed, we'll put it that way. And it turns out that this is just a characteristic of people who make creative breakthroughs, is they have to produce a ton. Most of the stuff is not good. Most of it doesn't see the light of day. Edison had over 1,000 patents. Most of them were totally useless. But that process of creative breakthrough turns out to be inherently inefficient. And so if you want to support it, you have to support these systems that allow people to kind of roam across projects and disciplines, because that process of creative breakthrough is chaotic, and most of the stuff that's done is not going to be the winner. But if you don't tolerate those losers, if you don't have a system that's resilient to those failed ideas that allow people to try all these different projects, then you don't get the breakthroughs.
I'm chatting with David Epstein about his new book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. And if you haven't read David's book, The Sports Gene, go check that one out too, because that was a fantastic book and so revolutionary when it came out. David, you also have the story in the book about Paul Ehrlich, who was a biologist at Stanford, came up with this idea, basically the population bomb, and that was, it made a bet. Can you kind of recount that story? Because I think it really encapsulates a lot of what you're getting at here.
Yeah, so Paul Ehrlich was a butterfly specialist, and he saw that in animal populations, what happens is nature doesn't regulate them delicately. Populations explode, they blow past the available resources, and then they crash. And he saw that this same thing was going to happen with humans, where population was increasing exponentially and the food supply was only increasing linearly, and so we were going to have this apocalypse. And he predicted, you know, by 1980 we would have, you know, half of the world's population would die out, there would be mass famine, world war, and so on, if we were lucky. If we got his unlucky scenario, we would just go extinct. And an economist named Julian Simon challenged him and said, you know what, I actually think the growing population means that there'll be more innovation and more good ideas, and we will avoid this so-called Malthusian catastrophe where you run out of food. And so they made a bet and said, all right, from today, Ehrlich was allowed to pick 10 commodities, five commodities, actually, it started with, and that he said if the price of those went up over 10 years because scarcity would drive the price up, then Ehrlich wins the bet. If they go down, then Simon wins the bet. And the price of every single one of them went down. So Ehrlich was incredibly wrong about his predictions. There's more higher food supply per person than ever. So in the 1960s, about 50 people per 100,000 died of starvation in the world, and now it's about 0.5. And so he was wrong, Ehrlich, over and over and over, but he kept just writing books and articles saying, yeah, I may have been wrong on the timeline, but now the population bomb has exploded, now we're headed for extinction and nuclear war and so on, and just kept doing that, and is still doing that. And he's an example of what I use in that chapter of a very specialized expert who begins to see the world through one lens and one mental model, and when they can't diversify their mental models, they become extraordinarily poor predictors of the world. And so then that chapter goes on to talk about the people who are much better predictors of political and economic trends, and those people are essentially just voraciously curious generalists with no single area of narrow specialty.
Even writing a book like this, and I talk to a lot of authors, and it seems like, especially novelists, they throw away about a third of what they write, and it never makes it into the final version. Is that the same way when you write a book like this, even about when you're, I mean, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, when you're writing about generalization, there's a lot that doesn't get in because some of it is just crap that you don't need.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes I go down these rabbit holes of something that's interesting to me, and I surface later and say, how did I ever think I was going to put this in the book? And even getting to that, where that stuff I don't write into it, I still, when I turned in the manuscript, it was 20,000 words too long. Because again, this book, it's an amorphous topic, right? Like how specialized or broad to be. And I think that's a conversation that's important to everyone, but that we usually discuss only using intuition. And my goal was to say, okay, let's put some evidence behind this conversation so they can be more productive and more interesting. But where to draw the line with what domains I would look at, you know, that was a pretty tricky issue, so I ended up cutting a huge amount.
What has your research showed you as far as the optimum age when this generalization should start with kids when it comes to sports?
Mid-teens. So I think the jury is still out on what would actually be the best, but what is typical for the elites is kind of mid-teens, like 14 and a half, 15. And certainly after, if you look at sort of some of the countries that track development a little better, like in Europe and Australia for soccer players, it's usually 16 starts the period of what they call focused investment, where you start dropping some of these other sports and focusing in much more narrowly. But they still, even then, until about 22, elites do more unstructured activity than do near elites. So even though they're doing a lot of practice and they're ramping up their practice hours, they still maintain more unstructured activity than do people who plateau at lower levels, who sort of get stuck in these kind of rigid motor patterns and things like that and aren't able to adapt as the game gets faster.
Well, I even think about the number one draft pick in this year's NFL draft had it walked away from one hell of a baseball contract to go play football. So it kind of, yeah. It was really a good point to this as far as what this book goes, that people who, he didn't specialize necessarily in college even, and he was, you know, a lot older than mid-teens.
Yeah, no, I mean, in fact, I've looked at this data before, and if someone has been drafted into one pro sport, their chances of having been drafted in another sport are many, many times higher than just a normal person who's been drafted into no sports. And that's because they have some traits that, you know, as I wrote in my first book, cut across sports, but also because this sort of multidiscipline early is the scaffold that allows you to then learn specific skills much more rapidly, and the specific skills are a lot more easy to take on board once you have that broad general, you know, what physiologists would call physical literacy, basically.
All right, the book is Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World by David Epstein. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. And if you haven't read David's previous book, The Sports Gene, pick that one up too, because you will learn so much about this. David, this is just a fantastic way to make this readable for people who all have kids and are trying to decide what sports to put them in, and just for life in general. So thanks for putting it out, and thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Teach your children well. Their fathers have